On the evening of February 12, 2026, the community room at the Bozeman Public Library was filled with people who had come to hear author Elise Atchison discuss her latest novel, Crazy Mountain, with journalist Amanda Eggert. Winner of the Eludia Award, Crazy Mountain chronicles a rapidly changing place and community through the diverse and conflicting stories of the people who live in a fictional mountain valley in Montana over nearly half a century, from the 1970s to the 2010s. As the rural landscape transforms into subdivisions and McMansions, conflicts escalate between locals and newcomers, developers and environmentalists, the wealthy and the homeless. Librarian Liz DeVries introduces the speakers.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to tonight's program. I'm Liz, one of the librarians here at the library, and I'm excited to kick off the Authors and Books series of 2026. Very quickly, before I introduce our speakers tonight, I want to thank the Bozeman Library Friends and Foundation for sponsoring this series. Without them, we wouldn't be able to do this and invite people in, so they've been fantastic to work with. And I also want to thank the Country Bookshelf for coming out and selling the book we'll be discussing tonight, and KVGM, who is recording tonight's program, just so you all know. Elise Atchison and Amanda Eggert are here tonight to discuss the novel Crazy Mountain. The novel is a character-driven look at the people and changes that have happened on a fictional Montana mountain and community over the course of 50 years. The viewpoints and the viewpoints expressed are rich and varied. Atchison is a local to the area and the recipient of the High Plains Book Award and the Eludia Book Award. Amanda Eggert is an award-winning environmental journalist and currently a staff writer with Montana Free Press. Her work has appeared in many local publications, including Montana Quarterly, Explore Big Sky, and Outside Magazine. With that, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to them because you didn't come here to listen to me.
I am so excited to be here. Elise and I are old friends, and she was part of one of the very first writing groups I joined when I was just a pup a while ago. And then I later helped out with the Elk River Writers Workshop, which led to me meeting my husband. And all of that happened via Elise. So it's really awesome to be with her today. I want to start by asking you a little bit about your writing process. And I know that you write both fiction and nonfiction. And I'm curious what you think about the benefits and drawbacks of each of those forms and how they relate to communicating about an issue that you care deeply about.
Well, fiction, I think, as in with this book, is this working right? It can take you into deep into the lives and minds of a character, so that you're in their shoes, you're experiencing what they're experiencing, almost as if you're them. I mean, so that you can be taken through these experiences. And in this book, you know, you're taken through the way that each character relates to the land and relates to the changes in the land, and it changes with each chapter, with each character. So you're getting like a wide range of changes in a wide range of perspectives on the changes in the land. And so that can take you deep in. I think fiction has been, there have been studies that show that it increases your empathy and understanding of people who are different than you, because you're actually in their experience in the book. And so that can really help us, especially in divided times like today. I think it can help us understand people who think differently than us, and sort of help us come together instead of be, you know, separate all the time. And then nonfiction, I mean, it can do, I write more essays or creative nonfiction, which you can take in any direction you want, but you can probably do a lot more factual. You know, you can put as much as you want about some sort of factual thing, which you wouldn't do in fiction. So you can relate more information, which can be really, really important if you're writing about something that's important to you. And in journalism, I mean, how would you describe your process in journalism?
I would say I used to try to write short stories, and now I find the prospect a little bit terrifying because you get a blank slate where everything is possible, and then I feel like sometimes I can write better with some sort of constraint or structure. So, I'm really in awe of people who can just start from nothing and create a whole world out of it. But when I'm writing nonfiction, journalism for Montana Free Press, if it's a more creative story where I'm trying to introduce some narrative elements, I get this big whiteboard out and then I just start like laying out the most interesting things, I think, and the most vibrant quotes and telling statistics. And then I try to find a way to put them all together in a way that's like enjoyable to read. And that's often very hard.
Well, I mean, I think journalism is so important right now. I mean, I think it's one of the most important parts of our society, along with libraries and independent bookstores, you know. But journalism, what you do is so important to where we are right now and keeping an informed public.
Thanks for that.
And she's a brilliant journalist. You should, if you haven't read her, check her out on Montana Free Press.
Thank you. Thanks. On the note of writing different characters with different belief systems and different backgrounds, I'm curious if there were characters in the book, because there's a broad range, right? We've got carpenters and firewood cutters, and we've got a couple of artists and a movie star and someone who's relocating for a little bit of their slice of heaven, a realtor, a mobile home park owner, like all kinds of characters. If there are some that felt easier to write and others that just felt a little bit more difficult to channel, if you will.
It was definitely a challenge writing this book because I got into so many different perspectives that aren't mine. And I think that some of them were definitely easier, but all of them started, I didn't know where I was going with each character in each story. It wasn't like I said, okay, well, a rancher is going to be like this or a real estate agent is going to be like this. It was developed while I was writing it. The story and the characters just develop while I'm writing it. And they're all individual to the story that I'm telling. But definitely the characters that have a closer relationship with the land were easier for me to write because, you know, I lived pretty close to the land and for decades. And so that's easier to draw on my own experiences. And it took some time. Some of them did require me to go over and over them to figure out who the character was and what they thought and why they were doing. Because I didn't want any stock characters and I didn't want any villains or any saints. You know, I wanted each of them to be fully developed. And even, you know, this isn't a book where the developers are these awful people. I want them to be real people. And they each have their own motivations and reasons for doing what they're doing. But definitely there were a few characters. I think the real estate agent, second chapter, I think I went over that again and again to get to where I felt like it was a real character. He was a real character.
That's Tony, right?
Tony. Yep. Whereas, like Mary, the rancher in the first chapter, that felt real natural to me, or, you know, some of the other characters that live really close to the land.
And one of the other things that I really love about this book is that the landscape itself is a character. The mountain, the forest, the wildlife that live on it are kind of its own evolving character that really anchors the story, but also goes through all sorts of transitions that are fascinating and really interesting. And on that note, I don't know if any of you are friends with Elise on Facebook, but she often posts these really lovely little snippets of her life living off the grid outside of Livingston. And I find it like such a fun, it's almost like, you know, how they have like the Osprey cams or the Grizz cams. You know, this like little window into a different existence for a little while. That's kind of how I think about Elise's Facebook, because she just takes these pictures of just little snippets of moments and wildlife that she shares the land with. And it's fascinating to see how integrated that is into her daily life in a really lovely way. So to help illustrate that, I'm just going to read a couple paragraphs from the book. Okay, without giving too much away, The valley had been cleared of all human clutter, the land swept clean, all was ready for a second chance. Soon the snows would come and bury the blackened landscape. Spring would arrive and green grass would push up through the ash-covered soil. Showy pink firewood would bloom right among the charred snags. Aspens would sprout from their sprawling runners, lodgepole pine cones would open to a sun-drenched landscape, and all that is wild would take back the valley. The golden eagles would fly back in and claim their nesting territories. The elk and deer would wander back in and graze on the new growth. The bears and cougars and wolves would follow their prey, ready to play their part in this age-old story. So that's just kind of a long run-up to asking about how you decided to write the landscape as a character.
I think in my life, the land, you know, there's a word in the beginning of the book, solastalgia, and it's the grief and loss and longing you feel when you lose a place that you love. And I really think you can love a place as much as you love a person, and you can grieve a place as much as you grieve losing a person. And so I think that my closeness with the land comes out in my writing because I've lived for decades, you know, and I've kind of centered my life around the wild world, which you have somewhat too. And so that it just comes naturally to me to write about those things. I don't think I do the Facebook so much anymore, but I used to post a lot of stuff on there. So it's really easy for me to write about those things because they're a part of my daily life. And I've spent a lot of time observing, whether it's mountain lions or bears or whatever, and as well as, you know, studying them outside of observation. So you just sort of a deep well of accumulation of experiences that I can draw on to write from, I guess. Does that answer your question?
It does.
I'm curious, now, I think you have a love of the land too. Does that work into your journalism?
It does. It does, though I often wish that I could bring a little more awareness and presence to my surroundings when I'm out hiking or skiing or, you know, camping with my boys. I love it so much, but often feel that I'm kind of scattered when I'm out more than I would like to be. Unfortunately, part of the human condition right now, I think that's probably not all that unique. Sadly.
I think you have to go slow to see, you know, you have to really stop and, you know, if you find a carcass, you might sit there for hours waiting to find out, you know, what's on the carcass or something like that, you know, or even a nest, you might watch a hole in the tree forever just to see what's there, you know, and so you do have to take the time to get to know the place.
Something that's come up pretty regularly in my work is this kind of collective anxiety about the loss of open space in Montana. I think that's like fairly widespread and pretty well documented in some polling. And I wonder if, you know, you're saying that you can grieve a landscape the same way you can grieve a person. And I wonder if you find writing to be a form of catharsis for that grieving, or if there are other things that that help you work through the loss of open space and wildlife habitat.
No, it still pains me. but I think that what I was saying before about how you're placed inside the characters and the way that they're experiencing the land, it can also increase empathy towards the land and the animals and the plants, depending on how you're writing it. So I think that can go beyond, that can raise, it can, I mean, I'm not going into writing with this goal in mind, but I think that sometimes it can just turn out that way, that you do have an effect on other people. I think it was James Baldwin said, he said that you don't write to change people, but if you can change just the way people see the world by just a millimeter, you can change the world. So if you can just, and I don't think that you're going into it thinking that, but still, if you're writing deep within a point of view or something, and he was writing, of course, from a black and gay point of view, and he did change the world with his writing. I mean, you can look at his writing and he made a huge difference in the world. So you know, when people say, oh, well, writing doesn't have any effect, it's had an effect on me. I know a lot of things I've read have a deep effect. So, you know, but I don't write thinking that it's going to have that big effect. And your journalism, I'm sure, has a lot more effect on, because you're keeping people informed.
But try to. And I guess that's something else that struck me when I was rereading this book recently is the mention of the Clovis child. And there are some interesting ways that you weave in events that are similar to things that have happened in the land or in local communities. And I guess I'm just curious, like, how that, I know that you're like a big consumer of news, both local and national, but I'm wondering how that kind of feeds into your creative process.
The local, what's going on in real life? Well, for instance, the Clovis child over in Park County, you know, we think of it as, it's sort of ordinary to us because it's been around so long, but it's really unique to the continent, you know, and it was excavated in a very haphazard way, but then the child was repatriated. And the way that worked into my fiction, is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Okay. The way that worked into my fiction, I mentioned the child in the book, but then I created a fictional teenage girl who is a teenage Clovis girl who is unburied in a very disrespectful way and then later repatriated. But her, the way that people treat her in the book is very similar to the way people treat the land, whether they respect. Whether they have respect. There's a quote by Aldo Leopold that I think is really relevant to this, because he said, when we see the land as something, as a commodity that belongs to us, we use it in a disrespectful way. But when we see it as a community to which we belong, we use it respectfully and with love. And I think this idea of community versus commodity, which commodity would be, and it's not straightforward. It's not like everybody who makes a living off the land sees it as a commodity. And even in the book, some of the people who make a living off the land see it as a community. But that idea plays out in all the characters, you know, on some spectrum of whether they see it as a commodity or as a community. And it plays out also with the Clovis girl. She's the way people treat her. And also Kate. I don't know, some of you might have read the book, but Kate is a character in the book who... it's very vulnerable, and she goes. She becomes homeless in the middle of the book, and the people who are treating the land really poorly treat her really disrespectfully, also. And the people who treat the land with respect tend to treat her as if she has intrinsic worth, even though she's going through this really difficult time. And I think, I wasn't thinking about this when I was writing it. It just kind of came out that way, and I think that's because that's kind of how I see that people are. You know, they either can see outside themselves and see the intrinsic worth and value of others, whether it's the land or other people, or they see it just as an extension of themselves and what they can get out of it, more of a transactional type relationship. I think I went way off the loop there, but
on the note of like having a respectful relationship to the land and seeing yourself as integrated to the health of the land is also kind of reflective of perhaps the health of your community. I remember hearing a radio program, I think it might have been on Terry Gross's Fresh Air. This is a few years ago. But the woman she was interviewing said, all thriving is mutual. And that just like stuck in my brain, like, you know, like a piece of chewing gum, and I love it.
Very, that's a good quote.
Also, on the note of Kate, she's a fascinating character because she's probably one of the main characters next to Crazy Mountain itself, but she's also someone who's primarily being viewed through different characters' perspectives, both people who, you know, admire and are interested in her and people who disdain her. And I wonder how you thought about, you know, if that was an intentional choice and how that came about.
It's interesting because when I began the book, Kate was no more important than any of the other characters, and I just started to realize she was showing up in every chapter, and I also started to realize that she was kind of playing that role of the character that was being disrespected a lot by the same people who disrespected the land. It wasn't intentional, it just kind of played out that way. And so once I realized that, I think I made her a more prominent character in the book. And what was your question again about her?
Oh, was it an intentional choice to make her character primarily viewed through the perspectives
of
the other?
I think all the characters are viewed through, which is what real life is like. You know, we all have our perspective. We all see things differently. In the book, what grabbed me and held me was the idea of seeing how each character interacted with the land and the changes in the land, because that was what interested me. And it was challenging, and it definitely took a lot of work to get into all these different perspectives. But I tried to give each their due. And even the people who treat Kate really awfully, really terribly, I try to give them humanity within the book, you know, even people who do horrible things. So Kate, she really just turned into the character who, she goes through the destruction that the land goes through and the resurrection, and she really just turned into a kind of a mirror of the land. And I think that's because the land is vulnerable to how we treat it. We can go in there and tear it up anytime we want, and she's a very vulnerable character in the book, So I think it just came, it wasn't intentional, it just kind of came out in the writing, which is kind of the way the whole book, there's a Doctorow, E.L. Doctorow quote that writing is like driving at night in the fog. You go as far as you can in the headlights and eventually you get there. You know, so when you're writing, you're just kind of going as far as you can, and before you know it, you figure out what you're writing. But you don't, it's, for me, every writer's different. I think that's important to point out. I'm talking about my process, and other writers that are much better than me use totally different processes. And that's what's so great about a series like this that the library has, is that we get to see so many different points of view. I love going to, and listening to writers talk about their process, because they're all different, you know? And everybody has a different subject that they're interested in, a different process that they use. And I think that's just really cool. I like it.
Yeah, I'm the same. Ever since I was little, I've always flipped back to the author bio page in the back of a book. You know, before I finish the book, just because I'm so curious about the person with all of these great ideas and how they do what they do. And it's just endlessly fascinating to me. And on that note, I would like to hear a little bit about where you draw inspiration, what different creative forms or even non-creative forms inspire your work.
Well, I would definitely list the land as the primary inspiration. I think because as long as I've lived, the land has been central to my life, and writing has been central to my life, and they just kind of weave together, and they have for so long that I think that that's just part of it. But for, if you're talking about other writers, it's the same kind of as experiences. I've had tons of experiences, because I'm old, tons of experiences that I can put into that is kind of a deep well I can draw on, but I'm never taking a specific experience and just fictionalizing it, or a specific place and just fictionalizing it. I'm taking out little bits of experience and places, and then, you know, using the imagination with the reality to, I guess, there's an alchemy, and something new comes out of it that's not the reality, and it's not the not just the imagination, it's the combination makes something new. And then what's really cool is that when a reader reads the book, they're bringing their experiences and their imagination, and they make something even new again. You know, this is set in stone, but every time somebody reads it, it changes. So I think that's pretty cool. But for writers, it's the same thing. Everything I've ever read, I think, has influenced me, and the things I've loved. But I'm not thinking of a specific writer or book when I'm writing. It's just in the steep well. And I think I've known writers who they'll study a writer who's doing something they really love, and they'll pick it apart, like taking apart an engine and putting it back together, and they'll learn how to do it, and then they'll use it in their own way, in their own work. I've never been able to do that because I just get, if I really love something, I just get lost in the story. And I just, that's not the way my mind works, but I still think I get it through osmosis. You know, I just, it definitely influences me, but it just does it at a more subconscious level, I think. And so it's just like everything I've ever read and everything I've ever, you know, experienced goes into that.
Do you have a specific practice for writing, like same time every day, same place, do the same things before or after, anything like that?
Generally, I just write when I have time. And I do like to be, I like silence. I'm one of those people, I wouldn't work in a coffee shop because I kind of immerse myself in what I'm doing. And I'm if it's fiction, I'm creating this world. So I really don't want to be interrupted while I'm creating that. But some people are able to write, and when you have kids, like you do right now, it's going to be pretty noisy. But people manage.
Yeah.
You've got a good husband who lets you.
Yeah, I was just to say, I don't try to work when they're around. Ooh, I can't imagine finishing a sentence, much less like a paragraph. Those guys bounce around. They're six. I've got twins who are six, so they're like, they are little chaos makers.
Do you have a process for your writing? Getting John to look after the kids is probably number one.
Yeah. Well, for journalism, when I'm Montana Free Press is headquartered in Helena, so I have staff members who have an office they go to there, but there's a few of us who are scattered around working remotely, and oh man. My only real consistent thing I think is if I'm like really trying to focus on something that's more complicated or creative, I silence this platform that we use to communicate in the newsroom called Slack. That is a huge productivity and efficiency maximizer and also such a pain in the butt for sustained focus. So that's one of the consistent things. And then the other thing, I guess, is if I'm working on a larger story, I like to like print a bunch of it out, lay it out in front of me, and give my eyes a break from the screen for a minute and just kind of play with that. And if I feel stuck about where to begin, I'll just start writing longhand. And oftentimes that'll lead me to an entry point into the story.
Yeah.
What's your preferred writing implement?
I tend to use the computer now. I mean, I started on, of course, manual typewriter, but I like to be able to move things around easily because I'll often change things drastically. You know, I'll just, you know, make a decision to change something really drastically, and it sure helps if you can just do that on a computer rather than trying to do it any other way.
Yeah, all my stuff eventually ends up on the computer for sure.
Yeah.
But it is. What do you have other tips for writer's block? Do you ever have writer's block?
I think I would sit down and just do whatever I could, even if it wasn't flowing as I might like. I think a tip for other writers would be, you know, there are roadblocks in the way when you're writing, and there are even people who will stand in your way when you're writing. And I think it's important to live the life you want to live and write what you want to write, and don't let anybody talk you out of it, you know, because your best writing is going to come from deep inside you and what matters to you. And so if someone else tells you, oh, don't do that, or it's not marketable or whatever, just ignore them and do what really matters to you as a writer, I think.
Do you have a rough estimate about how many books you read in an average year?
Oh, it depends. I mean, now I'm doing a lot of, you know, research reading, so that's a little different. That can eat into it, and it depends on what's going on in life. But I love to read. I'm not a rapid reader, so, you know, I don't read 50 books in a month. You know, I mean, some people just amaze me how quickly they read. But I tend to slow down, especially if it's really beautifully written. I'll go back and read the sentence again and again. So, you know, which is how I get that osmosis, I guess, of rhythm and whatnot. How about you?
Oh, it depends. I read more in the winter when the nights are longer. I don't read as much as I would like these days. I probably average, like, I would guess 1.5 books per month is my official estimate.
And you have to do a lot of research for your writing.
Yeah, I read a lot of, for work, I read a lot of other news articles or reports, lawsuits. interview notes, etc.
That's a lot of reading.
Yeah. Enough that I wonder if my short-term memory is often completely maxed out.
Wait till you get to my age.
What are you working on now, if you want to speak about that in a little bit more detail?
I've got a few projects going. I've got a nonfiction, which it's still in the process, but it feeds a lot off my experiences in the wild. So with my writing, it doesn't really take shape until I get well into it, because I'm not really sure what I'm doing until I write my way into it. So it's hard to describe something because it's not really set. And if I do set it, then I'm going to feel like I'm stuck in something. So I kind of like it to be able to form any way it wants while I'm writing it, because I sometimes change things drastically and even the focus. But that's very much about the wild and our relationship. It's similar in that it's our relationship with the natural world. And then I've got a couple of fiction books, but they are still need a lot of work. So I'm still a ways away, but they'll be coming out at some point.
One of the things that I really love about this little corner of our state is that there's a really vibrant writing community.
Yeah.
It's just so lovely that we have, and not just writing, but like creatives of all sorts. And I think that's just great that we have like basically kind of generations of that legacy now at this point.
Absolutely.
And I just think that's really lovely. And I love that you're a part of that. And I love that I happened to, I don't remember how exactly I first got involved in that writing group that I must have heard something about. I believe it was Livingston's Public Library. I used to live in Paradise Valley. Had a writing group write-up thing in the newspaper, I think, and I just stumbled on it, and I was like, that sounds great, and I joined, and then it kind of went from there. But how do you think about interactions with other writers and other creatives and how that features in your work and your process?
I really love to hear about the way other people work. I mean, some writers don't ever want to talk about writing, but I think it's interesting to see how other people work. It's just interesting. And I love that I think having a book out, you really see how the generosity of the writing community and, you know, how people really, and it makes you want to do more for other writers because you see how people go out of their way to help you. And it's really a wonderful thing to see. I think what worries me in the context of the book is that, of course, with rural gentrification, housing is becoming so unaffordable that, say, we were young working people, you know, young writers and young artists and young musicians, it's really hard to live here. And in Park County, you know, that came, of course, Bozeman has been the epicenter of the growth and development, but Park County is now coming along, and it makes it impossible for young. I've seen young writers come in and then have to leave because they can't afford to live there. And it used to be a cheap place to live. You know, I mean, that's you could. It was really cheap to live there, so you could follow whatever dreams you had. But I don't see that happening anymore. And I guess that's true in a lot of places across the nation right now. I don't know where that's going.
Yeah, I know a couple of writers who had to leave the state so that they could find.
Usually young.
Yeah, and they were, you know, even with like multiple different income sources trying to make it work.
Yeah.
So it's really a shame.
Yeah, I don't think that's the direction. I think we need to turn things around, but I don't.
I also like to ask people if they're, one of my like little journalist tricks when I'm doing interviews is to ask the people I'm interviewing if there's something I haven't asked that I should have, or any like closing or in summary thoughts. And so on that note, I'd like to ask you if there's something you always wish people would ask you about your book or your writing that you just never get asked, and what that is, and go ahead and respond to it.
Well, I don't think I can think of anything in particular about that, but I can come up with something. I've been asked so many questions, and
are there favorite questions you like to ask other writers, perhaps, that I can then throw back at you?
I think you've asked a lot of them already. I guess I would talk about how important story is in in our society and how stories, you know, help us understand each other. They help us, and they help us sort of move into the future and imagine new ways to solve some of the problems we're facing. And I really think that stories are crucial. And you know, we often say, oh, well, that's just, you know, a novel or a memoir or, you know, whatever. And I think that they actually, stories, whether they're verbal, whether they're written, whether they're in any form that they're in, they help us understand the human condition and how we can move into the future. So,
yeah,
I don't know. That doesn't really answer your question, but there you go.
One of the things that I've been thinking about more and more as I've gotten further along in my journalism career is how much psychology really has to do with storytelling and information communication. I think a lot about if the messenger matters a lot, maybe more than we give it credit for when we're conveying information, even if it's the same information. I wonder, like, if how it's conveyed, if it's a more creative form, allows it to sink in a different way or be heard or registered in a different way. I think about, you know, how videos and photographs compare to just straight up text. I don't know, there's just so much to dig into there that I wish I understood better.
And with this disinformation now and AI, you know, you can't even trust videos and photos anymore, and you can't trust some news sources that you should be able to, but I don't know where that goes. I think you try to tell the truth in your writing. Okay. Even if you might want to influence them in a certain way, I think you're very objective. And
on that note, I would, just because I have an audience here, I'm just going to go ahead and say that I'm really grateful for people who do talk to journalists when they have an informed opinion and do offer their insight. I think there's sometimes a little bit of hesitancy to go on the record, especially in such a, like, a politically charged time. It can feel like a scary or difficult thing to do. But you can't really do journalism without people being willing to share information and talk about what matters to them and why other people should care about it too. So the public plays such an important role in journalism, and it's more challenging now with government employees, for instance, feeling a lot more reluctant to talk to journalists, and that's completely understandable, but also makes the work a little more challenging, but still is just so important.
And people are probably, they have to see other people speak up before they feel comfortable, so it's what you're saying is really important just to start the flow of people speaking.
Yes, yeah, 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 it indeed is that case. Yeah, thank you all for coming out, and we wanted to save some time for questions, I think we have a microphone that's going to go around, and if you've got questions, let's hear it.
I must confess I haven't read the book yet. I had my hands on it, but my grandson wanted to read it, so I gave it to him, and I will read it later. Now, I understand the first part of the book is totally different than the last part. Am I right? What can you tell me about that?
Well, it starts when the land is totally undeveloped. So the first chapter is from the point of view of an elderly rancher who owns the entire valley, the 23,000 acres. And, you know, the reason the tone changes so much is because the place and the community change so much over time. So the tone of the book and the things that happen change because the land is changing and the community is changing. So the first chapter, which is sometimes my favorite because it's still all one piece, and there's the rancher has a very close relationship with the land. She's 82 years old, but she refuses to sell. But then it does change hands, and so the reason it changes so drastically is because the land and the community are changing. So you know, there's some horrible things that happen in the book, but there's horrible things that happen in life, and I guess I'm writing about life.
The reason I have such interest in this book is because, as a 20-year-old MSC student, when I was going to school, Barbara Van Cleave came to the campus and interviewed, and four of us decided to go to work on the Dude Ranch that they had for the summer. And that was a real experience. Is Barbara still living?
Is she?
A year or two ago, I saw a little clip on TV where she was. But I think we're about the same age.
Yeah.
I remember one time when I worked at the Dude Ranch, she had said when she interviewed us that on your free time, you could go horseback riding. Well, I went down to the corral one time and asked the Swedish cowboy to saddle up a horse. And she came out of the door and she ran down there and she said, "What are you doing? You're not supposed to be riding." And it was our time off. But anyway, that was just one of many experiences we had.
I often thought what the book would be like if it was written just from that first person's point of view and just about the ranching and the land still whole. But that really isn't what the book is. It's definitely about the changes and the loss that is happening as the culture changes and the land changes. So, yeah, I mean, the times you were speaking of, there are a lot of books written about that sort of thing. Joe Wilkins writes a lot about that, and Alamoris Jones, and just so many people. I know I'm forgetting. And, of course, if you wanted to go even further back to what I was talking about the, in, well, during the homestead times and before, when we had our first influx of houses going up on the land, and of course it was very recent that the relocation and genocide happened, and there are a lot of books, great books about that. I would suggest The Lost Journals of Sacagawea by Deborah Magpie Erling and Fool's Crow by Jim Welch. Both of those are really good. But you know, you have all these different time spans, and you can write about each different section. And what you're talking about is a really rich territory to write about. But after the first chapter, it goes down.
Well, several years ago, I drove up there, and nothing looked the same.
Yeah,
I couldn't even find the road into the Dude Ranch.
Right.
It had changed so much.
Right. It's sad.
The Van Cleave Ranch is one of the first Dude Ranches in Montana, I think. It's most of it is still intact, but the ownership has changed hands maybe twice, two or three times, but yeah, right? One of the, yeah.
I was hoping you could say a little bit about the title and how you named it and maybe when you named it as well.
So Crazy Mountain, this is another aspect of how fiction and nonfiction work together, because the Crazy Mountains, there are a lot of legends about the name of the Crazy Mountains, and one of them is the that a woman's family was killed and she ran off in the mountains and went crazy. And it's just a short description, and I took that in the book and kind of fleshed it out and made it into a more fleshed out story. And the title, I think, really fits a lot of what's going on in the book, whether it's with certain characters like Kate or on the land, or just the general craziness of what's going on in the book. And it just seemed like the perfect title for the book. And that's how that got picked.
I wanted to mention that Barbara Van Cleave is alive.
Oh, good.
And this particular book,
yes,
called The Crazies, she provided this photo on the cover of this nonfiction book that has been written. And she was at Elk River signing books and stuff. And this was a few months ago. So just in case anyone's interested.
What's interesting about that book and everything that's happened since this book was finished, there was COVID and there was, which caused a big influx of people who could work at and make money at the wages in New York, but they're living here, which of course greatly increased the housing costs. And the Yellowstone series brought in a lot of people. But what's interesting about mentioning that book is that after this book was finished, it's even gotten worse. You know, I mean, it's like growth and development on steroids, and it's I don't know. It's crazy. It's crazy. Crazy man.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very sad. It's very sad. I often read from the first chapter because I like the feel of that. But I'm going to read from later on after the land and the community is really being fractured and changed. Lance is a pizza delivery driver. I can mention that I've had a lot of the jobs that the characters have had, which allow me to bring them alive. Like there's a pizza delivery driver, there's a landscaper, there's a convenience store clerk, a bank teller, you know, I've had a lot of those experiences, so that helps bring the characters alive. But this particular character is a young man who delivers pizzas, and he, and I'll just give you the background that Kate, who we already talked about, is homeless in this chapter, is already homeless, and he brings her a free pizza once a week. So Lance left the pizza palace during the Friday rush and headed up Crazy Mountain Road with a bag full of pizzas. When he pulled into the pump pit, he saw two boys running out of the woods. The taller one was carrying Kate's old green barn coat. The boy stuck his hand deep into the pockets, his fingers fishing through the coat's innards, but he came up empty-handed. He said something to the other boy, and they both laughed. He tossed the coat on the pavement near the dumpster where it landed with its arms outstretched like a limp body. Lance jumped out of the car and yelled, "Hey, where did you get that coat?" The boys glanced at each other and took off running in different directions. Lance walked to the edge of the parking lot and entered the woods where the boys had emerged. He moved slowly through the trees, his dread growing with each step. Finally, he glimpsed a blue tent up ahead. As he got closer, he saw long slash marks running down the side of the tent. The boys must have stabbed the tent over and over again, shredding the thin nylon fabric. Lance pictured them whooping and laughing as the knife sliced through her only protection from the elements. "Kate," he called out in a shaky voice. "Kate, are you okay?" There was no answer. His hand trembled as he pulled back the tent flap. She wasn't in there. Lance stood still for a few minutes, listening for any sign of life in the forest around him. Then he made his way back to the pump pit. When he reached the dumpster, he looked back and saw her standing at the edge of the woods. He let out a deep sigh of relief, and he picked up the crumpled coat and held it out to her. She walked over and slipped her arms into the sleeves. Even though it was a warm day, she fastened every button. He went to his car and retrieved the pineapple and ham pizza and set it down beside her. By the time he got back to his car, she was already wolfing it down like a half-starved animal. He wondered how it would feel to feed a hunger that deep, how it would feel to live in constant freefall with nothing to break your descent. It was a dizzying thought. So that passage kind of reflects what I said about the way people treat Kate. This particular person has a lot of respect for the land, and he has a lot of respect for Kate, even though she's homeless and in her worst period of her life. So that's kind of, and you said how it changes. Well, yeah, it's a very fractured community at this point, and the land's, you know, it's, we're seeing the results of that. In the housing, lack of housing, affordable housing.
I just want to add that that's one of my favorite chapters in the book.
Oh, thank you. So
there's something hopeful about it, but it's a great transition to see what had become of the people.
I want you to clarify, did you finish that book before that?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm reading that book right now.
That's really, she does a fabulous job, I think. It kind of addresses a different subject but it still has the Old West, New West clash in the book.
How long has that book been out?
It came out in 2022, and unfortunately, I wish it was irrelevant now. But unfortunately, it's actually probably more relevant, and I wish it weren't. I wish it went just died, and the growth and development was no longer a problem, but that's not the case.
I'm sort of curious about why we haven't learned from our past, and why we're going through this again. And I grew up in a world where, wow, you saw National Geographic and all the programs on animals, the land, the environment. I think many of us were affected that way prior to our parents and other generations. So we've had inundated a lot with positive messages. And, you know, we came out here 12 years ago, and we're a lot like you. And I'm a lot surprised about the way people behave towards the land. And I keep asking myself, why haven't we learned? And so I'm curious, is there any thoughts that you might have that could kind of push us a little quicker and a little faster to take care of our land?
I think, for one thing, fiction explores the questions. This is an old age comment, but fiction explores the questions but doesn't provide the answers. But nevertheless, I think the more we get outside our own heads and even try to understand the people that you're talking about, you know, try to understand where they're coming from and why, and you know, maybe find a way to work together. I think as I grew up in a time when ecology was just really becoming a thing, and so it was taught heavily in school. I don't know that it is anymore, and I think it should be an important topic in school. I don't have answers to anything, but I do think that we need to try to work together more instead of just continually going in opposite directions and fighting each other. I wish I had answers.
Right. I want to thank everybody for coming tonight, and thank these two for entertaining
thank
us.
Thank you. Thank you.
You have just heard author Elise Atchison discussing her latest novel, Crazy Mountain, with journalist Amanda Eggert. It was recorded at the Bozeman Public Library on the evening of February 12, 2026. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced by Joy LaClaire for broadcast and archiving on Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman, and KGVM.org. We thank you for listening and for your financial support.